Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Brain Injury Radio Network. Tonight is our regular Wednesday installment of our program Recovery Now with your host, Kim Justice. If you'd like to know more about my story, you can find it at inaflash.org. I, too, am a fellow traumatic brain injury survivor. I appreciate you tuning in tonight, and as always, I look forward to your input. So now, we'll get on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another balmy night in the Midwest. This is Brain Injury Radio, the Recovery Now show, and I'm your host, Kim Justice. Going to take care of a little housekeeping, and I see we have one of our guests on the board, and we're waiting for the other. So, Marshall, I'm going to be doing a couple minutes of housekeeping if you maybe want to text Kelly. I try to, but it's his home number. In any case, welcome everybody for being here on the show tonight. I want to remind everyone that Brain Injury Radio is on 7 nights a week, same time, same number, 10 different hosts, all bringing something different to the table. These shows, once they are aired live, then immediately are archived and go into the on-demand section at braininjuryradio.com. So there should never be a time that you'd feel isolated in your recovery. By all means, come to these live shows where we do take callers a little bit later for questions and comments. But you can also hear the archived shows. Also want to talk to you about, and I'm going to type this in the chat for you in just a second, but the website, the number 4, PEER11.org, 4PEER11.org. That is a hotline, a peer-to-peer support line where one survivor can call in and talk to another. Ultimately, it's going to be running 24/7. I think they're up to about 8 to 10 hours a day and looking for volunteers. So if you're looking for a way to help another survivor or to get a little more purpose in your life, spirit of giving back, certainly check out that site, 4peer11.org, and it will tell you how to sign up for the training, and then they're only asking for 4 hours a month. The other thing that is very interesting and useful on that site is the medical, pardon me, ID card. A lot of people wear the Medic Alert jewelry. Some people maybe have a piece of paper in their purse that winds up getting crumpled and lost. This card, our founder, Craig Cecilia, did a lot of hard work on. It's the size of a driver's license, and it's got one of those swipey things on back that can include quite a bit of medical information. So if you have a brain injury, PTSD, like a couple of hosts, myself and a couple of the others that have some of the old hardware in your head that shouldn't be exposed at all to magnetic imaging, you can put those kind of things on the card, and the first responders and medical professionals will be trained to use these, and all they'll need to do is swipe them and be able to get your medical record. So it's a pretty cool thing. Be sure to check that out at 4peer11.org. If you're out there listening on the computer and you have a glitch, I will let you know you can also dial in and listen to the show. The number here is 424-243-9540. We usually, on my show, do the interview or the topic first and then take callers who have questions or comments. So I will alert you a little before that and give you the number again, but please feel free to call in and listen, and then press 1 when I tell you it's we're taking calls and comments. And with that, I think I will get on to our guests tonight. Healing from war's devastating effects isn't easy, but it is possible. For every wounded warrior, there is a wounded home, a family and community impacted by their loved one's war experiences. Service members returning from combat deployed bring war home with them. And when a combat veteran struggles with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and or traumatic brain injury, TBI, every family member experiences the effects: confusion, hurt, anger, guilt, fatigue, and fear. Wounded Warrior, Wounded Home offers a hope-filled way forward, giving hurting families a look inside the minds and hearts of combat veterans and guiding them to develop their own plan for physical, emotional, and spiritual wholeness. This is part of the back cover of a book called Wounded Warrior, Wounded Home. Tonight, I'm honored to have the co-authors of this book here with me. I'm going to tell you a little bit about them. Marshall Carter Waddell served with her husband, CDR retired Mark D. Waddell, a Navy SEAL, for 25 years around the world. She's an international speaker and the founder of Hope for the Homefront, based in Fort Worth, Texas. Her books include Hope for the Homefront and When War Comes Home. Our other guest is Dr. Kelly Orr, who has more than 30 years of experience in behavioral medicine and pain management. He serves on the advisory council and speaking team of the Hope for the Homefront. He retired in 2004 with a combined USMC and Air Force career of 25 years and now makes his home in Colorado. So without any further ado, I would like to welcome both Marshall and Dr. Kelly Orr. Are you guys with me?
Yes. Hi, Kim. It's good to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, hi, Kim. I'm here.
And once a Marine, always a Marine, right, Dr. Orr?
That's right.
Okay. Just wanted to say that. My dad's one of those, and I've been hearing that all my life. Once a Marine, always a Marine. So I see that you were both. Now, were you not, when you were a Marine, you served in Vietnam, is that correct?
I did. I actually I had a very, what I call a vanilla tour. I was kind of in a support unit. Support responsibilities, so not right on the front lines like a lot of my friends were.
Sure. Well, in any case, I want to thank you for your service, and you too, Marshall. You guys put in a lot of time and a lot of service for our country, and I want to thank you for that up front and first of all. Tell me a little bit, I think we'll start with Marshall, and maybe start at the beginning and tell us what happened, a little bit of your history that brought you up to that defining moment that was a game changer for you and your family.
Okay. Well, thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for thanking us for our service. It's been our honor to serve and our privilege to serve. However, it's not been easy, that's for sure. Mark and I were high school sweethearts, and we married after I completed college at Arizona State University, and he was already serving as a Navy SEAL out in Coronado Island, California. And I really didn't know much about military life. I didn't know anything, and I didn't even know what a Navy SEAL really was at the time. I learned very quickly, and learned that it was not just the service member that serves, his or her entire family serves. And to give you a little picture of what I mean by that, we, as a family, completed 11 deployments in the course of his career, and that's not counting the train-up period. So, you know, on average, Mark was gone 8 to 10 months a year, every year, for the duration of his career. And so that put a lot of stress on the home front, and it continues to do that, and those that are continuing to serve. He retired in 2006 after 5 combat deployments. One was to Kosovo and Bosnia and Macedonia area, and then 4 deployments to Iraq. And the turning point for, I think, for our family was when he returned from Iraq the first tour, which was his second combat deployment. And we just started noticing different changes in his personality and in the way he handled what I felt was normal family life for a household with 3 teenagers. And it raised a lot of concerns. And when I would try to address the situation, you know, it was quick, the discussions were quickly shut down, and I was told there was no problem, and it was certainly not our problem, it was my problem. And so I just turned inward, thinking that maybe our marriage of 20-plus years at that point was just being pushed to the limit and maybe coming apart at the seams. But once I did reach out and seek help for myself there in Virginia Beach with a counselor, and once I had written a little bit about what I was learning about post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury, I learned that our family was not alone and that the journey we were on was a similar journey that thousands and thousands of other families were experiencing at that time, and now, sadly, hundreds of thousands of those families. So Mark continued to deploy to Iraq 3 additional tours, and when he was stateside, he was serving as the director of operation for the East Coast SEAL teams there at Naval Special Warfare Group 2 in Virginia Beach. And so he never really had a break, you know, from the war. None of them did, and he did not. He certainly did not have an opportunity to show any what I call chinks in his armor or to ask for any help. And certainly at that time, post-traumatic stress disorder or any mention of it or any hint of it carried with it a great big stigma that threatened his, you know, or he felt would threaten his career or his ability or his what others perceived as his ability to serve. And so these invisible wounds just went unmentioned and they went untreated, and we just plowed through life in a maze of pain and confusion. And that was not the answer either, because the symptoms didn't go away and the issues just deepened. So I would say the turning point for us was around 2004, after his first deployment to Iraq.
Okay. And was that when you wrote the article? There was kind of an article that you had written that you told me about, and it kind of started the dialogue with other people in your situation, because at that time, as you say, you knew that there was a change. Everybody in your household knew that there was a change, but it was kind of like that elephant in the room. It just wasn't going to be discussed. So I imagine you felt isolated, confused, the other things that I read off of the back of your book, and were probably feeling very alone at that time. And so tell me about the article that got you connected.
Okay.
to the extent it kind of started you down this road, didn't it?
Right.
And let you know that you weren't alone.
Well, he was sent home from Iraq in the middle of his first deployment because a British commando jumped on the back of his left leg and broke it. But he didn't know it was broken at the time, and he continued to fight for 7 additional weeks, pushing their way up toward Baghdad. And eventually they said, "Sir, you know, you need to go to the rear with the gear and have this looked at." And sure enough, it was broken, and it ended up needing surgery. So he came home and had the necessary surgery and the necessary rehab. But our family, even though Mark's physical wounds were healing and his leg was, you know, healing and he was able to get back on duty, we recognized that psychologically, you know, and on a soul level, he was still very much wounded. And for a period of about 2 years, I was in a state of confusion and a state of hypervigilance, not knowing what was going to happen next at home. You know, raising three teenagers, 17, 14, and 12 at the time, and having to explain, you know, why daddy's different every day, trying to keep the peace on the home front. And so as a writer, I wanted to find out what was going on, and I wanted to reach out and find out if there were others out there dealing with this as their service members were returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. And so I spent some time in the Virginia Beach Library and found only thing I could find was material written by the spouses of Vietnam War veterans. And they talked about something called post-traumatic stress, which is something I'd never heard of. And I brought this up in my own counseling sessions with my counselor and came to learn what post-traumatic stress disorder looks like. Sounds like, smells like, tastes like, and I knew immediately that's what we were dealing with. And so I wrote the article, and a magazine called Today's Christian Woman picked it up, and they published it in 2007. And the feedback from that article just confirmed to me that we were not alone. It was, you know, at the same time, it was a real comfort to know that I wasn't alone, but simultaneously it just broke my heart that that the homes on America's home front were wounded, and the numbers of those homes just continues to increase. And so our family moved to Colorado, and I sought out another counselor, and it turned out to be Dr. Orr. And Mark and I went to him as a couple for marital counseling for under a year. And then I continued as a client on an individual basis. And after several years, just had the opportunity to author this book, Wounded Warrior, Wounded Home, and I was just honored that Dr. Orr would bring to that book the clinical perspective and all of his many years of experience in dealing with individuals and couples post-trauma. So that's sort of the chronology of how I found out there were many, many other families out there around 2006, 2007. And then the invitations began to come and speak, because really nobody was speaking transparently and with the level of vulnerability and authenticity that apparently I was doing at that time. And so we spoke all over the country, sometimes as a couple and many times just me on my own, and even to the White House twice. So it's just been an incredible adventure. Being able to reach out and to encourage these families and these spouses, and then also to advocate for them on Capitol Hill.
Wow, absolutely. Now, Dr. Orr, you had probably heard, you know, the PTSD of today, I think, is, did they not call that shell shock in some of the earlier wars?
Yes, they did. They called it many different things, shell shock, trench warfare kind of syndrome, battle fatigue, et cetera. Being in the Vietnam veteran generation and coming back in the 80s, the late 80s, was when I began to really see this much, much more prevalent in my practice. And started working with a number of vets and vet centers in Seattle, Washington. But it was still really kind of a cloudy issue at that time. We, you know, even though people were beginning to think, yeah, there is something here, it's one of those problems that kind of evolved over time, you know, from being called the Vietnam syndrome to some kind of a stress syndrome to post-traumatic stress disorder, and now chronologically we have now the American Psychiatric Association's a new diagnostic and statistical manual 5, which has revised the diagnosis of PTSD. I was just reading something on that, and they in fact have even responded to a lot of military leadership that want the disorder idea taken out because of the stigma that's associated with that, and this is one of the problems that we see with so many of the military members.
Right.
Is that if it's now, disorder. Sorry.
I'm sorry. Go on. Now, that book, that is, that new edition just came out like in May, didn't it?
Yeah, it's just out. Just brand
that's,
new.
That's what I was thinking.
Right.
And they
want
to change it already.
Well, it's it will probably be forever a work in progress because that's the nature of that document. As new research develops and new findings come and help us redefine things, and actually, they have changed some of the criteria, and I actually like some of the ways that they've changed it. Instead of three criteria, now they have four, and they have really looked at the whole avoidance issue, which I thought the previous editions had kind of downplayed. So they've done some very good work with that, I think, and it's like I said earlier, it's a work in progress.
Would you mind, I think by now, you know, most people have heard of PTSD and think they have an idea of what that might be about, and I'm sure it exhibits itself in different ways, but as far as you being a clinician and having book in hand, can you just explain that you were talking about the four criteria? Maybe explain a little to the audience about what PTSD really is in case they think they have an idea and it's maybe not quite right, or they have no idea and it's just something they've been hearing an awful lot about the last few years.
Sure. Well, based on the latest criteria from the DSM-5, PTSD originally was classed in the anxiety disorders, but it's now reclassified in a new class called trauma and stress-related disorders. So I think we've made a good move personally in really classifying it closer to what it actually is. It's more of a trauma stress-related problem. The conditions really require exposure to a traumatic or stressful event. The whole idea here is that the exposure to trauma links the conditions that are related to anxiety and fear-based and some anger or aggressive stuff, some dissociation, where a person actually may go into some kind of amnesia. They won't remember things very well. But overall, the clusters now are really defined by these new different criteria. So, for instance, a person in these new criteria, things like intrusive thoughts or memories, avoidance of memories or thoughts or situations that may trigger memories, negative alterations in the way a person thinks or in their mood, and then changes in the way that they respond, that their arousal and reactivity. So what we now have is something that that actually defines it in terms of those four things, the intrusion, the avoidance, the negative alteration of cognition and mood, ways of thinking and their feeling, and alterations in arousal and reactivity.
Now, here's an interesting change. The diagnosis no longer requires fear or helplessness or horror that happens right after the trauma. That was removed because the research really didn't support that. Then there are some other criteria for children under the ages of 6 or younger. The interesting thing that I have seen is that they have included now very interesting inclusion, and that is sexual assault. I don't know why that wasn't as prevalent before, but it definitely is part of the criteria at this point.
So it's no longer classified as an anxiety disorder, but they've actually created a new category of traumatic stress disorder?
They have. It's called, the new class is actually called, entitled Trauma and Stress Related Disorders.
Okay.
So it's not, you know, one of the problems that we had before, I guess I must speak for myself on this, it's like, how do you distinguish this from an acute anxiety attack? So there was this kind of a linear decision tree as a person intensified in their direction of disorder. But what this has done is taken it into a new direction, I think, that specifically relates to trauma or a trauma event or a stress-related event. That is extremely traumatic for the individual. The other pieces of that, in terms of implications, I think, are that it really narrows down traumatic events. So, for instance, an unexpected death of a family or a close friend due to natural causes is no longer included in the diagnostic criteria. So that would go probably more into a mood disorder criteria or cluster. The other interesting thing is that some of the research is showing that the prevalence for PTSD for DSM-5 criteria was higher among women than men, and the prevalence increased with multiple traumatic event exposures. So policemen, first responders, EMT, firemen, National Guardmen who are involved in natural disasters, those people are now actually kind of in what I would call the pipeline for developing the potential, at least, for PTSD.
Right. That's very informative and really good information. I appreciate you explaining that the way that you did. When you said, you know, in the course of maybe a lengthy death experience, what about something like a lot of our audience here who are survivors of brain injury have a sudden traumatic event happen, which was a ruptured brain aneurysm, you know, perfectly healthy at age 35, you know, living a good life and having ideas of how my life was going, just like Marcelle and her family, and then something that, you know, takes you to a coma, causes you to have a craniotomy, is a game changer for the rest of your life because of residuals and just the trauma of that sudden event happening. And then you talked about things like sexual assault or possibly if a person had been in an abuse situation as a child and maybe were in the war later and went through some of these traumas. You're saying that a lot of things can fit into this PTSD category now that involve the concept of trauma.
Yes, I think that's right, Kim. You know, it's interesting that you would raise that, the traumatic brain injury, because my work definitely worked with trauma survivors, motor vehicle accident or multiple kinds of accidents where people had traumatic brain injuries. But for the past 12 years, my wife and I have been living this very personally because she suffered a brain aneurysm in 2001, April 28, 2001. It's a day that will never escape our memory.
Right.
So we've been living with all of the details of that. And, you know, the irony of it was that I became much more sensitized to both trauma survivors and traumatic brain injury survivors. And as a professional treating people, recognizing that I had two lives. One was a treater, one was a professional, a clinician, and the other one was a caregiver.
And it
really is. There's a life before and a life after, isn't there?
Yes, there is.
And learning how to deal with that. Well, you know, in the context of my clinical work with soldiers, with the military folks, seeing both what was happening to the individual military member who had suffered a brain injury and also watching what was happening to the family, you know, that resonated, you know, all the time with me.
Yes.
And Marshall and I have had conversations about this. That's one of the pieces of the book that is kind of embedded and woven through there, is that there is a different appreciation for not just the implications or the cost of a military life or any kind of trauma event, but there are hidden costs that most people in the public world really don't see. And your audience probably is going to recognize and resonate with that idea, is that a lot of times people just simply don't understand and don't know what to do with the survivor. And whether
right.
that's PTSD, TBI, or, you know, one of the things that we're seeing here is that there's a unique combination of PTSD, TBI, and anybody who's gone through a traumatic event, who's been in coma, who's been in an automobile accident, you come out of that a little traumatized, I think.
That's an understatement, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely right. Absolutely right. Especially from a rupture, because that's so sudden. You're taken down now. You know, it wasn't, there are some of us out there, I know, that go in and have a routine scan about something else and an aneurysm is discovered, and that's scary and traumatic enough. Anything that, you know, is involving brain surgery, but, you know, when the thing actually ruptures and I'm going to get right back over to Marshall, but, you know, I couldn't talk all of a sudden, and then I couldn't comprehend, and then I was gone.
Yeah.
And that all happened in a very short period of time. And for those that haven't experienced it, and I know a lot of our audience has, when you're inside that body and that dynamic is going on, it's terrifying because you're used to being able to talk. You're used to being able to comprehend. And one of the last things I remember is, just before I stopped being able to comprehend, was when I still knew in my mind what I wanted to say, but I couldn't get it out like that, and my parents are trying to fill in the sentences for me, and already, obviously, the thing is spewing blood through my brain, but the anxiety of not knowing what in the heck was going on and the frustration out of the blue of not being able to talk or comprehend, you know, I think that the trauma, big trauma, started that minute and only got worse for a period of time. The reprieve I got was the coma, I think, and then kind of got another kickstart when I woke up and did find out what happened and then go through the recovery process.
Yeah.
But but we'll go back now. Marshall, I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, just to piggyback on that, Kim, is that we still don't have clear speech, and Kathy still has difficulty understanding every once in a while. And oftentimes, from a spouse and a caregiver standpoint, and this is one of the things that I've seen with many caregivers and many survivors, is that there's a guessing game that happens. And it's so important to figure out clear ways to communicate. And I'm sure that Marshall can add a lot to this with her experience with her husband and his traumatic brain injury.
Great, and I want to go to that. The last thing I would say to both of you and to you, since your wife is still recovering, is one. I use an acronym I heard in another program of recovery, but the word HALT. I find that my symptoms are worse if I'm hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. Any one or any combination of those will make me not as quick on the uptake, maybe start a little of the stutter, get confused more easily. So that's just in the FYI. You know, when my residuals seem to accelerate, I try to come back to the basics in my mind because I don't want to jump to that something awful is happening again. I want to go back the other way to the basics and say, well, you know, have I eaten well today, you know, or maybe had too much sugar, too much caffeine, you know, am I feeling lonely or isolated? Am I feeling angry? Did I not get enough sleep? Is it a combination of those? And so before I rush to panic, which just accelerates all of my symptoms even more, I have to step back and just look at some of the very basic things that, you know, that we take for granted a lot of the time. So if that's any help at all, HALT is something you might want to take a look at. Everybody here, you know, our survivors, to you two guests, that's something that I found very useful in the course of my recovery. I've got a few acronyms because otherwise I wouldn't remember them, but that's been a big one for me because I bet 7 times out of 10 I've got, you know, 1, 2, or all of those things operating at once when I'm at my worst.
That's true. We watch those very carefully. It's interesting that you would put it that way. I have never seen the HALT. That's right spot on, Kim, because whenever, especially the tired, the fatigue, boy, that's a killer. So we watch time really, really carefully and make sure that sleep is at a premium.
Absolutely. Okay, Marshall, we didn't forget about you. you and Mark were going to see Dr. Orr together, and then he decided he didn't want to do that anymore. He didn't want to do it anymore, or he thought he was well enough, or just done with doing therapy?
The way I remember it was he was just done, and he felt that he had gleaned as much as he was going to glean from that environment of counseling, and I personally didn't feel that I had enough tools at the time to continue, you know, improving. So I made the decision to keep going to counseling sessions with Dr. Orr, and my husband decided not to continue.
Okay. And so obviously you guys are still married. He's done, but you're knowing that you can't go on the way that it's been, or that you're going to need support. And if you're not able to get it in the family, obviously you guys had developed a relationship with Dr. Orr, so you were 5 years invested at that point with seeing him. And so you continued on. And how did that process change for you when Mark wasn't involved anymore?
Well, when we were going, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Orr, but what I remember is when we went as a couple, the focus was on the service member, my husband, and rightfully so. That, you know, the image given to me was that there was an onion that we needed to peel a lot of layers back before we could even begin to talk about the marital issues. We had to talk about the PTSD and the traumatic brain injury issues and all of that, all those layers. And so our counseling sessions, the time that we were with Dr. Orr, we focused on my husband. And so what changed when I started going as an individual was, and we had to work at this because, and I think maybe this is true for a lot of family members, is that the one that you love remains the focus. It remains your focus in life because you're constantly trying to figure out what's going on. You're constantly looking for better solutions and improvements to how you're handling situations. So when I would go as an individual to Dr. Orr, we had to make a conscious effort to keep turning, almost like a big ship, you know, like keep turning the ship away from focusing on the service member and focus on me as a family member and what I could do, and learning to discern those things that I could change and those things that I could not change in our relationship and in our home life. And so the focus was more on the caregiver from that point forward, and that was really helpful to me.
Now, that was another thing I wanted to ask you, because, you know, we have survivors on the show and we have caregivers on the show, and when your husband was healed from his physical wounds, you know, now we kind of think of, on the show a lot of the time, we're talking about a caretaker in the context of, like what Dr. Orr was going through with his wife, particularly in the beginning, and still now, where someone's got a physical situation going on, coupled, you know, with the mental burden that goes along with that. And so you've got a traditional, quote-unquote, caretaker going through that compassion fatigue. Now, in your case, are you still considered a caregiver in that you weren't doing some of those things, but you were caregiving, trying to be supportive of Mark and also your four teenagers? So it sounds to me like it's the exact same dynamic. A caregiver is a caregiver is a caregiver. Is that wrong?
Well,
or?
Yes. Yeah. Well, our situation and the situation of probably about 400,000 service members' families right now, because that's the number that the Pentagon is and some other studies are saying that's going to be the number of diagnosed traumatic brain injuries as a result of these two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The difference with our situation is that there's a long road of what I call discovery. It's like you're not quite sure what's going on. The service member hasn't had a penetrating head wound. You know, there's no for most of these service members, there's no place on their head where you can visually see, okay, my spouse has been injured, his brain has sustained an injury. So, you know, that's why it's called an invisible wound of war. So there's this long road of not knowing what's going on. You've heard about PTSD, but yet you're seeing signs and symptoms in your service member that don't fit the criteria exactly. There's some other things going on as well. And so you have to ask yourself, there's something else going on here. So that's what I call the road of discovery for us, which was long, and it was really difficult. But once that diagnosis was made, you know, in a weird way, it was it brought up a sense of relief just knowing what we were dealing with. But then we had to get on the road of recovery. So for service members and their families, there's this long, confusing period of time where you're not sure what you're dealing with. And then you get to a point where, okay, the diagnosis has been made. We're dealing with a mild or a moderate traumatic brain injury, and then you can start the road to recovery. So, you know, I think for a long period of time, you're wanting to remedy the situation as the spouse. You're wanting to help, but you don't, the diagnosis hasn't been made, so you don't really see yourself as a caregiver. Then once it's made, you have to learn how to be a caregiver. I mean, you don't want to be. You want to be the spouse. You want to be the lover. You want to be the partner. You didn't sign up to be a caregiver, right? So you have to learn a whole new role. And it's strange, you know, because you're managing paperwork with the VA. You're managing medications. Now you're dealing with, again, parenting as a single parent in many ways. And you're also having to communicate to the extended family who, in most cases, don't understand or believe what's going on. And so you're in this new role as a caregiver of a service member, which I'm grateful to say that my husband stayed fully, you know, very, very functional. I mean, wouldn't you agree, Dr. Orr? He was able to continue working and to continue at different jobs providing for our family. And in many cases, I know many women who are dealing with much more severe situations. But yeah, there are different levels of caregiving. And, yes, every service member spouse of a TBI service member is a caregiver to a certain degree. Absolutely.
Now, you talked about statistics a little bit. And I wanted you to go back over those a little. One of them that you told me that blew me away earlier. And was that one in three of our veterans coming home now from Afghanistan and Iraq are being diagnosed with some degree of PTSD?
Yes. I just did some research this past week just to make sure my numbers were correct. And the numbers right now are 1.6 million service members have deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan since 2001. And one out of three of them are reporting signs and symptoms and concerns of mental health issues that line up with PTSD. And so, one in three. So we're talking about 500,000 individuals that are concerned about their mental health as a result of their service.
Now, about the TBI part of it, out in the general population, it's unfortunate that the veterans coming home are shining a light on the rest of the population that has suffered a traumatic brain injury. But when you got that diagnosis, I would imagine, you know, part of the reason that the veterans were getting this diagnosis maybe a little bit quicker is because they were coming in bulk. You know, when there's that many coming in one group of people that are exhibiting these symptoms, the doctors really have to pay attention. And so you've called it, I've called it, I think we've all, you know, who have read up on this a little bit are calling traumatic brain injury the signature wound of this war. And so did you easily get that? Now, I know you're going through your period of discovery, but were the doctors quick in diagnosing that TBI?
No.
Or, yeah, I thought so.
No.
Okay.
No.
Tell me a little bit about that, because we're all going through that.
We were kind of at the tip of the spear, so to speak, in this whole tsunami of invisible wounds coming back from the two war fronts. So there wasn't much, you know, in around 2003 and 2004 and 5, there wasn't really much talk about post-traumatic stress disorder. And then around 2005 to 2008, when my husband was diagnosed with traumatic brain injury, there was really no talk about traumatic brain injury. So, you know, we would get a lot of blank stares from different medical professionals when we would ask about traumatic brain injury. You know what? But once I met Dr. Orr and I talked with a couple of other service members who said, you know, has Mark ever been tested for TBI? I was like, what's a TBI? I've never heard of TBI. What is that? And they said, it's traumatic brain injury. And so I went back to Colorado Springs and asked Dr. Orr about it, and he knew, you know, the steps to finding that diagnosis. But again, the services were not in place at that time for Mark to go and get those tests or to do that through the government system. We had to do that on our own, and we had to pay for it out of pocket. And so I'm really happy to say that now there's more attention being paid to that, and I'm sure Dr. Orr could speak to that more intelligently. But at the time, in 2008, this was, you know, we were frustrated because we couldn't find the tests that we needed readily, and like I said, we had to pay for them out of pocket. And so, but, you know, we were glad to do that once we figured out what was going on with him.
And what kind of tests did they do to substantiate the diagnosis of a traumatic brain injury? I'm just kind of curious, as being a host around here for and bad memory is one of my issues. So anyway, we've been here, I don't know, 10 months, a year, or something like that. You know, what I'm hearing out here is that diagnosis isn't made very rapidly. It's normally,
no.
You know, we're going through things like our memory's not so good, maybe our vision has some problems, we've got sensory overload, full basket syndrome, just, you know, there's a laundry list of items just from being a host the amount of time that I've been, that when I had that laundry list personally, but like you, felt very alone and isolated because I went 17 years without ever meeting another survivor or getting any kind of support. And so it was a real eye-opener for me when I was able to be a host on Brain Injury Radio, because every time I would listen to a show, I would be going, my God, I mean, these people were checking off my laundry list every time I was listening to a show. And I thought, for God's sake, we're all out here with these similar residuals. Of course, we all got our, you know, our own individual aspects of our story. But as a host listening, I'm hearing this laundry list come up over and over and over, regardless of how the brain injury happened, whether it was a TBI or acquired brain injury or brain cancer, a tumor, any kind of an assault to the brain, this post-concussive syndrome they're talking a lot about now. I think that's one that the military is also picking up on.
Right.
And
right.
So it wasn't really going any quicker for you guys until I guess the numbers started stacking up in the VA, and then they couldn't really look the other way anymore.
Right. And I think Dr. Orr is the best one to direct that question to, about what type of testing Mark underwent, because he was the one that was guiding that process for us.
Great. Dr. Orr?
Well, that includes a pretty extensive neuropsychological evaluation, which is really a battery of different tests that really assess how a person is thinking, their motor function, their behavioral function, the way they are able to use words, both in terms of using words, memory of words, learning a list of words, and which tests your short-term memory, your long-term memory, and then really how a person makes decisions. So is that executive functioning? So that's a very extensive test battery, which depending on the person can last upwards to 6 to 8 hours. So you can understand how, as a clinician, you know, my background in behavioral medicine, as part of my fellowship training, we studied neuropsychological testing. I'm not a neuropsychologist, so I refer to neuropsychologists that I know that do these tests. But remember that one of the things that is part of kind of the result of a traumatic brain injury is fatigue. So many of us, I think, are always very concerned when we say you need a neuropsychological battery, because we know this is a very time-consuming and exhausting process. So a lot of times we'll do some screening. We may use some of the subtests to give us some pointers and kind of move us in a direction, and then that'll help us make a decision in terms of, okay, how intensive do we want to do this? As Marshall was mentioning, that is a very extensive process. It's an expensive process. Mm-hmm. The VA has gotten better at doing this, and the military have identified neuropsychologists in them in the different branches that provide those services for the active duty personnel. And the VA is doing this, but honestly, you know, the whole system is really overwhelmed right now with the numbers. You know, when you start talking about half a billion people, you're talking about overwhelming numbers of people. I do want to say one thing, though, about one of the treatment options for traumatic brain injury that you may have run into or people in your audience may have run into, and that's neuropsychological, neural rehab. Using neurofeedback. Mark and I did neurofeedback, and it was very helpful for him. And there are a variety of platforms that can be done. I've used both low-energy neurofeedback and also more traditional forms of neurofeedback, along with stress management learning and relaxation. Cognitive refocusing, all kinds of things, because I think the survivor really needs all the benefit of as many different skill sets as they can get. So,
I got a question for you, just from my own experience, and I don't mean any disrespect. It's a question. You're the messenger. Hopefully, you didn't design all these tests. And I'm glad I got to keep you this long, just in case you are the guy who designed them all. But I took some of these tests, and like one of them, for example, was showing me pictures. There was, I don't really even remember, but a series of pictures that had things in them. And one of them I remember, there was it was a picture of a family sitting down at the dinner table, and then she showed me, you know, several pictures, and then wanted me to go back and remember. Well, at the time, you know, my career for 25 years had been as a financial consultant, so I was investing people's money, and that's not really something that you can afford to overlook detail on. Take a decimal point, for example, in your pension plan. Okay, so we're looking at the pictures, and she comes back and she asked me about the one, and I said, well, there was a family sitting down to eat, and she was asking me questions, and I said, well, okay, I'm gonna guess there was a husband and a wife. I know there was a couple of kids. I don't remember if they were boys or girls. I'm going to guess maybe one of each, because the old Dick and Jane thing, you know, that rounds out the family. You got mom, dad, a boy, and girl. So I'm guessing. I'm not remembering. I'm trying to piece it together. And I said, but I don't remember what the food was on the table or the color of the walls or if there was anything hanging on the walls or what the people were wearing or even what color, you know, they were wearing. And there was a couple of times where I was coming close. She could tell I was tired, like you said, fatigued, getting frustrated, getting anxiety, because I wanted, it was like taking a test. You want to get it right, you know. And she would prompt me a little bit on some of these things when she'd see that I was close. And I just wondered, I guess the bottom line is, you know, on some of the tests, it seemed like, I know there must be some scientific empirical reason to need a lot of these tests so that somebody can put together a diagnosis, but if somebody would have just believed me or asked me what the difference was in my estimation of how my mind ticked before and my emotions and how they were operating now, and the differences that I noticed before and after, it seems like they could have saved a lot of the tests. Now, I'm not quite sure. You know, those did show that I had some memory, because I could tell you one of them was a family sitting at the dinner table. But as far as sending me back out and thinking I'm going to be able to go back and do what I was doing before, or anything that would require that kind of detail or recollection. And by the way, I forgot all of it within 24 hours. You know, my short-term memory was toasted, so I can't even tell you what the rest of the tests were, except that they really wore me out. And I remember thinking at the time, you know, you get to that, did they throw the MMPI in there? I'd rather be a flower pot than a piano player or whatever, you know, the trick question test, you know, that one's always kind of gotten to me. I'm like, yeah, this is really germane to my life, you know, as I get up and live it each day. I guess you have to have as much education as you do to understand why that isn't as ridiculous as it felt to me, in pain, ready to pass out from fatigue, burst into tears or anger from frustration, and feeling like a child wanting to pass my English test and having the teacher help me.
Yeah.
I mean, how accurate could that have been?
Well, anytime you add different kinds of things like that, if you're writing this a report, if you're giving this an evaluation to somebody or you're doing it for somebody and you're writing a report, you have to put in those exceptions, and you have to interpret everything, all the results, accordingly. So you have to be very careful about that. I know that we do testing for a variety of reasons. I've done the testing for court purposes, for forensic kind of reasons. I've done it in a variety of different states and around the world for the military. One of the things that you always are very, very sensitive to is the state of the person that you're evaluating and working with. And if you're fatigued and you're frustrated, you know, then you make exceptions to that and you work, you do what you can. I hope that the person that you were working with was sensitive to that and actually worked with you a little bit more. you know, neuropsychological testing is very, very extensive, and there's not just one thing that you can do. You know, there are I'm just looking online right now, and there are 5 or 6 different tests that a person can use to test intellectual functioning. Mm-hmm. And you can use subsets of that to make estimations. In terms of achievement or language processing, there are 4 different neuropsychological tests you can use. So, and, you know, on and on. In terms of memory kinds of things, attention concentration, for instance, there are 7 different options that a person has to look at attention and concentration. Plus, you know, I can only speak for myself, but I was, as a clinician over 40 years, you learn how to assess attention and concentration kind of subliminally. I mean, I monitored that all the time when I was working with people. So in terms of memory issues, you know, one of the simplest things to do is to do a 5-minute memory test, you know, ask the person to remember an apple, table, and a chair, and, you know, or apple, penny, and table, just 3 things. And then you ask them to remember, you know, after 5 minutes, and then after 10 minutes, and then after 20 minutes. And that gives you a picture of what their memory is doing. You know, we can do more extensive things. There's a test where you give them 10 words, a list of 10 words, and you give repeated opportunities for them to learn that. So that's a learning memory process. So, you know, we're not in the business of exhausting people, hopefully.
Especially when they come in that way to begin with.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. So, you know, like my bias is that, you know, we want to care for you, the person that we're trying to work with, and find ways of making your life most functional. And I suppose that I'm more sensitive to that after Kathy's accident, you know. I would like to tell you that I'm the best caregiver in the world, but then I'd have to be honest and tell you that I failed about 10 times today. So, it's a learning process that is a lifelong, you know, that's our life now. So both as a clinician and as a husband, you know, this is the love of my life, and we're in this. So we're not gonna ditch it. We're gonna stay the course. So
well, it is 2 different things too. You know, you got to cut yourself some slack. You're a clinician, and you've been talking to people about caregiving, but wearing those moccasins is a little bit different, isn't it?
It sure is. Yeah, there's a professional side of me that that listens carefully and offers hope, offers answers, offers some suggestions, and gives behavioral tools. But then there's also the me person that, you know, I come home, take off my tie, and now put on my moccasins, and I'm walking in this, and they're 2 different worlds. Yeah.
The last thing I want to say, and then I'm going to switch to Marshall, and I do want to tell the audience that in just a few minutes we will be taking questions and comments. So if you want to dial in, our number here is 424-243-9540. Again, 424-243-9540. If you think you might want to have a question or a comment, go ahead and dial in. And in just a couple of minutes, I will tell you to press 1 if you've got questions. Just a last note with you, Dr. Orr, and then I want to go back over to Marshall for a minute. But it was funny you brought up that list of words. My dad had occasion earlier this year to take that test, and I was there with him. And he took the test, and they read him the 10 words, and then he was supposed to turn around and spit them back out, and he did. But I was sitting there listening, and the first word was apple, and my mind the way it works. My mind locked on Apple. And then I couldn't remember. I mean, it just locked on that first word. Like, if I could get that first word, the rest of them would flow. And I had to think about something that most people would do as a reflex. He turned around and got 9 out of 10 of them right, and the one that he missed was actually not even, it was darn close. It was in the same category. It was something about money, and it was a, he was just off a little bit. So for all intent and purpose, he passed the test, but I sat there 18 years after my incident, stuck on Apple. Suddenly feeling really a lot of anxiety, you know, because I hadn't been in a testing room for a while and I wasn't being tested. I was just with him. But as I sat there, it scared me. You know, it scared me. It disappointed me. All kinds of emotions got elicited, and that was that many years later. And I thought, you know, if that therapy, if I wouldn't have fallen through the medical cracks, I guess, in those 18 years, it took me 17 years writing a book and becoming a radio host to find this stuff out. Usually people don't have to go quite that far to get these things taken care of. But anyway, Marshall, back to you. I had to stop you on the list because that was so germane to something that I just experienced with someone else just a few months ago. So I just want to leave it at that. Don't tell me anything about that apple. But so Marshall, you continue to go to Dr. Orr, and you're getting some help. And in the meantime, tell me a little bit about the kids. Are your obviously, they're not knowing what's going on. I would think that the dynamic would be a little bit like an abuse or an alcohol kind of situation, only from the standpoint that a kid doesn't know what to expect when they walk in the door. Is this going to be a good day, a bad day, a mad day, a glad day? And there's that not knowing. How were your kids at handling the situation? Were they in their own therapy program? Did they need it?
They were not in counseling. They were not in a therapy program. They were, you know, I was trying to keep the peace at home and keep life as normal as possible. So they were, you know, involved in school and after school activities and sports, but they were not oblivious to what was unfolding at home. I mean, there was no veiling that 100%, of course. And so they began to exhibit what Dr. Orr taught me is secondary traumatic stress and some of their own secondary post-traumatic stress symptoms. You know, living with a parent who has been traumatized turns the world of a child or a teenager on its head. And as the parent that was not injured, I had to seek out resources that gave me the tools to know how to communicate with, you know, my son, who at the time was 17, 18, and my daughters, who were 12 and 13, 14, 15, 16. You know, there's different levels of maturity, and therefore there's different ways to communicate to children at different ages about what's going on in the life of a traumatized parent, which is a real challenge, and there's a real need right now for more resources in this area and more, just more help along these lines. And so it was difficult, and so they went through their adolescence living in a state of confusion as well, and going through all of those stages of grief that I was going through, knowing that their daddy was different. I mean, you know, and then coming to me and asking me, is this a good day for dad? Is it a bad day? You know, trying to plan their own lives of when to have friends over and when not to have friends over. And,
right.
when to ask for things that, you know, that teenagers want to ask for, you know, a prom dress. You know, there had to be a strategy behind everything they did. And I remember coming across my youngest daughter standing in our walk-in closet, and she had a sleeve of her dad's shirt, and she was holding it up to her face and, you know, smelling the scent of her dad. And she looked up at me and said, I miss the old daddy, you know. So they had to get to know a new daddy. They had to get to know a new personality. They had to come to understand, and they're still on that journey, coming to understand the process of change and the reasons there have been changes in their dad, and therefore in our marriage relationship and in our family dynamics overall. I mean, the entire family is wounded, and that's what the book Wounded Warrior, Wounded Home is about, and that's what our conferences are about when we hold our retreats. The retreats are entitled When War Comes Home, Don't Retreat. And Kelly Orr and I and a number of others, we have traveled around the country and tried to pass along these tools and resources and the encouragement and the hope that we have found on our own personal journeys to spouses of wounded warriors. As a matter of fact, we're going to be doing one in Omaha, Nebraska, the first weekend of October. And we'd just like to let your listeners know that, and that they can find more information about that weekend for spouses and for female family members of combat veterans. Any woman whose life is connected to a combat veteran is welcome to come to this. It's the first weekend of October in Omaha, Nebraska, and you can find more information at hopeforthehomefront.com. And so we're doing one. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I'm going to put your Hope for the Home Front in the chat. But I was going to say,
okay,
you know, this particular program goes to 36 countries and all over the United States and has AM
Wonderful.
Rights and part of the United States and in England. And then, of course, these live shows are archived immediately after, so people will continue to hear these shows. But I might have you send me a flyer. I'm really excited because I'm in Omaha, Nebraska, and this gives me a good segue to thank the sponsor of my show, Lash Publishing, and Marilyn is coming with you to Omaha to help with this retreat. And so I'm excited that I'm going to get to meet you and Marilyn, and I want to thank Marilyn for sponsoring my show, and I think it's really cool that I'm going to get to meet you both in the fall.
Yes.
And it would be good if you could send me, when you get that information, my husband is a 20-year retired Air Force, and he works as a civilian, a contractor. Well, actually, he's a government employee now, I guess. The contractors kicked him to Uncle Sam. But anyway, he works at STRATCOM at SAC Air Force Base. And so if you can send me some information about this retreat, I can see that we get it on base to the people that need it and maybe help.
Thank you. I had lunch today with your sponsor, with Marilyn Lash, and we were planning this retreat and talking about the content of it. We're also doing another one in November in Columbus, Georgia, right by Fort Benning, along the same lines. It's called Hope Beyond the Battle. So, but anyway, this is something that Hope for the Home Front has aimed to do, and we've done seven of these. And Dr. Orr was a part of these as well, as we traveled from coast to coast and just trying to pass along these tools and these resources and the hope and the encouragement that we have found on our own journey. So we've also launched what we call Hope for the Heart online communities for groups of women. And these are forums online where they can talk amongst themselves confidentially, and they can ask each other questions, and they can provide the emotional and spiritual support that that we so desperately need, you know, as we're living similar journeys. So those Hope for the Heart groups are also listed on hopeforthehomefront.com for people that would like to explore that and maybe join one of these groups. And we even have a group that's led by a woman in Nebraska that's just for moms of wounded warriors. And so that's a whole nother angle, being the mother of a wounded warrior, and how do you go about that? Because your son is an adult man, and how do you communicate differently, or how do you effectively care for him and not hover over him, and especially if there's a spouse involved in that situation as well and you're the mom. And so that's another Hope for the Heart online group that's available through Hope for the Homefront. Just wanted to let them know.
Good, and I hope that you'll put me in touch with that person, because that would be a good person to come on the program too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'll do that.
Hey, Kim, let me break in since you brought up your sponsor, the Lash and Associates Publishing, they have a wonderful book entitled Supporting Survivors and Caregivers After Brain Injury, a Program for Psychosocial Support. I'm looking at it right now. It has been very, very helpful. I wanted to put in a plug for that. You can find that at Lash and Associates Publishing.
Got it. Both of those websites in the chat room for everybody, and you guys have said it out loud. You can find, hopeforthehomefront.com is Marshall's site, and do check out lapublishing.com. That is Lash Publishing's website, lapublishing.com. They are strictly a publisher of brain injury-related materials, and they have an extensive collection of material just for veterans. And tell me again, hit me again with that title that you gave me. I started typing, and then the title was really long, and you lost me.
Yeah, it is. Sorry. Yeah, it's Supporting Survivors and Caregivers After Brain Injury.
Okay. Good.
And I want to put in a plug for an excellent book written by Marilyn Lash. It's called Explaining Blast Injury to Children and Adolescents. And that was a great resource for me in helping explain these things to my children.
Yes.
Explaining Blast Injury to Children and Adolescents.
Right. And tell me, and anybody who wants to ask a question now, again, I'm going to give you the number. Put your hand up if you have a question. The number is 424-243-9540, and we're going to take those questions in just a minute. Marshall is on the East Coast now, and I promised her I wouldn't keep her up to the wee hours of the night, so I'm not going to keep her much longer. But the last thing I think I would say, and then I'll see if there's any last thing you guys want to say, and then we'll take any callers, but when I was going through your book, it looked like one of the things we all have in common is that we go through a grief process when we realize that we aren't going to be able to step back into the old me. We're not going to be able to step back into that old skin and just resume our life like it was before. And there's a grief process that goes along with that period of the process. And then you come to accept that you're going to have to find the new me, and you want to make that new me have a life worth living. And that's kind of where we differentiate around here between a survivor and a thriver, is that you want to have a life worth living. You've gotten a second or a third chance, up at bat. And so you need to take actions. And one of the things that I say on my program notes every week is we focus on the four A's of recovery: awareness, acceptance, action, and adaptation. This is a place for survivors striving to become thrivers. And so I also say that this is a we recovery program, because it's in the we that we're able to find the new me. So as I was looking through your book, I saw a lot of that process, talking about the grief process and talking about the concept of letting go of an old me and growing into a new me. But that just doesn't happen to the survivor / thriver. It's a dynamic that happens with everyone in the family, because whenever you have a relationship, whether it's two people or a family unit, and one changes, the rest of them are all going to change too, as a reaction. That just seems to be the way it works. Is that right, Dr. Orr? That's been my observation, but I certainly don't have the credentials to back that up, just some common sense, I guess, or just observation. Is that about it?
I think you're right on there, Kim. I actually call that living grief. It's something that happens in a process. It's a daily kind of things. The definition is the incremental dying that happens daily when individuals, relationships, and families are severely traumatized. The healing process requires permission to grieve that which was lost, a long-term perspective, and a teachable heart that yearns to better understand how we human change, how we human handle change and loss. So it doesn't take place in a straight, tidy timeline. It's about a lot of back and forth movement, a lot of unexpected ups and downs, somersaulting over itself. It's a process that impacts everybody that you know, not just your immediate family. It impacts circles of friends, and it can impact complete communities at times. So, but in order to thrive, and I really like your word there, it's necessary to be willing and courageous to step into that stream and move along with that current for a bit.
Yes, I agree. I want to close my part, and then anything you guys have to say, and then we'll see if we have a couple questions. But I'm just going to read one of your reviews. There were several reviews on this book. And again, in a minute, when I get back to the chat room, I'm going to type in both books and something else I'm going to ask in just a minute. But here's a review from Lee Woodruff, best-selling co-author, In an Instant, co-founder of the Bob Woodruff Foundation, contributing editor to CBS This Morning. And he says about this book, Wounded Warrior, Wounded Home, "No family, not even a military one, is ever prepared for the holes that war and conflict punch out of our loved ones. This is a must-read for anyone living with or loving individuals with post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury." So I would take it from Lee and check this book out. And where can we find your books?
You can find them at any bookstore. You can ask if they're not already on the shelf. You can ask for Wounded Warrior, Wounded Home, and I'm sure they can access it and get it to you within a day or two or three. You can also access it at hopeforthehomefront.com. We have a little bookstore there where you can also find it. So.
Okay. And on your website, do you have that? You have your book availability listed on that website?
Yes, we have a little store there. Just go to hopeforthehomefront.com and just click resources or store, and all of the books will come up there.
Good. That's just great. So perfect. So I've typed that in the chat room notes a few times, folks, and I will do it again just as we're ready to go off. So again, for those of you listening, homefromthehomefront.com, and you'll be able to find access to the books. These books, this book that we're talking about tonight, and the one before, and certainly we'll be able to make contact if you need to that way. And if you have questions, of course, you can always get a hold of me, and I will pass the word or the question on to Marshall and Dr. Orr. I know on Brain Injury Radio we have a mailbox, but I haven't figured it out yet. And so if any of you do have questions, please go to my website, inaflash.org. That's inaflash.org, inaflash.org, and there's a tab right there that says contact the author or contact author, and that will send an email directly to me. And that way, you know for sure I'll be getting the email. Anywhere else right now is a little iffy for me, and I'll do everything I can do to help pass your question on. We do have a couple of people with questions. Is there something that either of you would like to say in closing, or do you want to go right to the questions and then do it, or how are you feeling?
Let's go to the questions.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let me see here. Okay, got one here. If I can get him unmuted. Caller 800, who do we have on the line?
Well, this is probably Kevin.
Hi, Kevin. How are you?
I am doing fantastic now that I actually got through to you. Right? The interesting way I had to connect, I actually had to call CenturyLink and have them put this call through, because when I tried to make the call, it wasn't connecting. So moving forward, I'm glad that we were able to bring me on the show. So thank you very much. And to your speakers, Dr. Orr, this question goes out to you, sir. I was medically retired from the Marine Corps after sustaining bilateral orthopedic injuries as well as a traumatic brain injury with complete brain shearing. It took them a little over 7 months to finally diagnose it was a TBI with personality changes. Much more than that, they provided me with no information. But one of the things that you had mentioned about the neuropsych battery testing, and you had said that it takes between 6 and 8 hours for those folks. I had gone through it on three different occasions, but my question to you is prompting by the examiner, is that normal or part of the process? As Kim had shared that she remembers, you know, them being shown a variety of pictures and then having to describe or, you know, recount some details of these images. Would it be appropriate for the examiner to say, well, did you happen to see anything red? And obviously that may or may not prompt the testee to go, oh, yes, yes. And if they do, how is that really, factored in?
Well, it's factored in in the report, because when you write the report. And in fact, that's a great question. And by the way, thanks for your service, and I'm so glad that you survived. And that it sounds like your cognitive functions are pretty good in spite of some shearing, because that's a fairly severe process when that happens. But look, any time we do testing, and you deviate from the standard procedures, you factor that in. You say the patient or the person, the individual, this person responded to prompting this way and was able to gather a little bit more information. That gives us a little bit more information about the way a person's cognitive functions are operating at that time. So,
No,
it's not standard. Standard procedures are pretty strict. When you deviate from that, you put that into the picture, you factor that into your results.
Okay, because the reason why I brought it up was I was one of those fortunate few that were, I guess, examined at Madigan Army Medical Center in 2005. And it wasn't until after that particular examination that my diagnosis had been changed from a traumatic brain injury to an adjustment disorder. So I guess that would be my next question, is kind of like, is that SOP, or is that, I mean, what would be an underlying factor that would prompt a doctor to say, no, this isn't a traumatic brain injury, when all evidence prior to this initial exam or specific exam was, you know, diagnosed traumatic brain injury with personality changes and so on and so forth. So what could have been a determining factor that may have swayed the attending physician to change that diagnosis from a traumatic brain injury? I mean, obviously, one couldn't speculate what he particular, but I was curious in your experience if there's anything that may be a factor.
I have no idea. So you no longer carry the diagnosis of traumatic brain injury?
Not with the VA. It wasn't until in 2010 they adjusted my rating because of PTSD. It was associated, my traumatic brain injury was associated with PTSD. But, you know, speaking on behalf of veterans, you know, and, you know, working with veterans, I know this is one of the things that, you know, PTSD is a secondary injury, so to speak, to folks with brain injuries, which was part of the reason why it took them so long to figure me out, was because I displayed, you know, multiple symptoms. You know, while I couldn't remember the incident, I had no problem talking about it, or because, well, I was just regurgitating what was told to me. But the symptoms were a result of, you know, like you said, like we discovered, as a secondary injury to traumatic events. And so I wasn't officially diagnosed with PTSD until 2008. And how that even came, I don't know, but I just remember reading it in my medical records. So moving forward to kind of enlighten other folks who may be experiencing similar situations, especially for our veterans.
Right.
That's where I'm kind of reaching out and wanting to discover, hey, you know, is prompting a normal standard in this type of neuropsych battery testing? And if so, those, you know, people that are experience that need to make sure that it's being factored in accordingly.
Yeah, absolutely. You're correct. I have no idea why they would remove the traumatic brain injury. You know, one of the really difficult things that we're all experiencing right now is the combination of TBI and PTSD. A very, very difficult process to factor in to filter out which is which, because they look so much alike and they mimic each other a lot, although there are differences. You know, the cognitive fatigue that goes with TBI is different than the physical fatigue that goes with PTSD because of the effects of sleep loss. They're different,
right.
You know. In one, you're working very, very, very hard to learn with the TBI, and that causes the cognitive fatigue. On the other hand, the PTSD and the sleep disorders that accompany that results in the physical fatigue. So, you know, fatigue is fatigue, and it's hard to decipher sometimes. Or which one are we talking about? Are we talking about both?
Right.
So it gets very, very complicated. Actually, I'm glad that the VA has you with PTSD, because that actually gives you a higher rating, I think, but I'm disappointed that the TBI issue is not there, although you sound like you're functioning pretty well cognitively.
Well, I have. It's been 10 years since my incident, but I, my bride of almost 10 had divorced me because of it. My cognitive abilities and interactions with people were, and still to this day, you know, it still happens. Not as much, but you know, where I, you know, I'd have no filter, and
yeah.
I would say something. And while it's true, it's just, oh my God, I can't believe. Yeah,
yeah.
You know, like for me. It's, yeah, I have seen prettier babies, or somebody say, "Oh, would you like to see a picture of my family?" Like, no,
you know,
unless
and,
they're the ugliest
that,
people in the world, I don't really care to see them. You know, no offense, but
yeah,
I don't think
yeah.
they're.
But the little things
like that.
That's the TBI talking, and that's the diagnosis of the TBI stuff. You know, here's the interesting thing that I've seen too, and probably a lot of people out there that are listening to this. Would agree. You know, you go, you have a traumatic brain injury, and the standard is a CT or an MRI. Well, if you have
it doesn't show up.
If you have micro shearing, that doesn't show up. Not only that, it doesn't show up for 3 or 4 months. Sometimes 6 months later, all of a sudden you're having trouble remembering directions, or you have word loss, or something else is going on. You can't remember the directions in some task that you've done a million times, and you're confused, and it's like, wait a minute, why is this going on? Or you're like, here, there's no filter, and it's like, wait a minute, what's going on now? They said my brain was okay. Well, here's
right.
the deal: unless you get a PET scan or a functional MRI, you're not going to see that. I do a quantitative EEG. And then that gives me information that I never would get from an MRI or any of those other functional resonance tests, because I'm looking at a whole different level of cognitive and brain functioning. I'm looking at how the neurons are working and how they're talking to each other. So,
right.
you know, it's a complicated process out there.
And it is. One of the things I will attribute to my success, beyond having an amazing, you know, we talked about caregivers. My caregiver happens to, before we met, I shared that my wife of almost 10 years asked for a divorce because she couldn't deal with my TBI anymore. But this woman that I had met and is now, you know, my partner, I'm proud to call my partner, she happened to be a rehabilitation counselor for deaf and hard of hearing students for 15 years. And so we've been working together for coming up right on 5 years now. And since 2008, August of 2008. So, yeah, almost 5 years now. And but one of the key things that, you know, beyond that, pharmaceuticals, you know, I don't think, you know, I know a lot of people listening, everybody is like a snowflake, just like a brain injury. No two brain injuries are alike, and different people take different things because of their brain injury. When
right.
It was suggested that they put me on Zoloft and Prozac, you know, having an understanding of what both of those drugs do to the human body, I was like, no. My bride at the time had encouraged me to find a natural method. And so since 2009, I've been legally authorized to use, cultivate, and possess, and utilize cannabis. And I have discovered through using sativa-dominant strains that, you know, I'm more cognitively aware and function, and it eliminates the pain. Whereas if I use indica-dominant strains, I'm more relaxed, and it helps me sleep a lot better. I can sleep up to about 6 hours with you know, being medicated with cannabis, whereas before I was waking up every 2 to 3 hours at best. So, I guess the reason why I was sharing that is because, you know, you made a comment about how I appear to be cognitively functional. I can appear that way for a period of time, but you know, most people, you know, and that's typically the extent of our interaction with one another is just a couple hours out of the day or a couple hours out of the week. But for caregivers and the people living with the brain injuries, that's 24/7. And that's what I want to encourage and remind listeners to keep in mind is that spend 24 hours with somebody with a brain injury before you make any judgments. Because it's, you know, like I said, I mean, I can appear normal. I look like a normal guy. But to look at me, you never guess I was 100% disabled. But, again, I am. And, you know, it's through, doing what Kim's doing and being actively involved in helping other folks create that functional life with an emphasis on fun, you know, that's really been helpful for me. And you guys had mentioned a recovery. We can't really recover. I mean, our brains will never be the same. But we can create a more functional life. And I appreciate Kim and you guys coming on the show and sharing your story and your book with us, because that's definitely going to be helpful in increasing that brain injury awareness and inspiring people to remember, hey, it's just something to experience. Now let's move forward. So thank you very much.
Well,
thank you, Kevin, for calling in. Thank you so much. And when I use the term recovery, I don't say recovered. That would be my distinction. You know, my particular show is called Recovery Now, and it's because my personal belief system is that recovery is a process that can take a lifetime from one thing or another. We spend a lot of our lives in recovery. And so you won't hear me use the word recovered hardly ever, like never. So that would be the way that I would distinguish recovery as just being a process or a way of life where you're looking to enhance your life and make your life better and improve yourself. But I don't think we ever reach the pinnacle until we're maybe on the other side. So in any case, I guess I've got just one more, and then I promise I'll let you guys go. I do want to say we have 15 minutes in the live portion of the show yet. I do have overtime where we have casual chat or the audience members. We can talk more about this subject, and I play some good independent musicians. So if you want to stay into the next hour, you do have to call in to 424-243-9540, or in about 12 minutes you'll just get dropped off. However, in the archive, the show is there in its entirety. So one more time, if you do want to stay and talk a little bit more after I let our guests get to bed, please call in now, 424-243-9540. And one last thing I'd like to say, since my guests brought up some of the resources at LASH, is that they would also be aware, and I've been telling you guys this, in April, LASH came out with a new magazine that comes out every other month or six times a year called Brain Injury Journey. And if you go to that website, I gave you in the chat room there, lapublishing.com, and you look over on the left side of the homepage where everything's listed, just a little ways down, you're going to see Brain Injury Journey. Click on that. It'll take you to the magazine page, and up top it's going to tell you what it costs to get to subscribe to the paper version of the magazine. Certainly do that, but if you scroll down a little to the middle of the page, their online version of this magazine is free. You can't beat the cost. So I encourage you, all you need to do is go to that page and and click, and I think it's just your email, and then they will send it to you. And I will say the first issue came out in April, the second in June, and the August issue they're just laying out now, so it should be out in the next couple of weeks. And I would think if you went right now and signed up for that magazine that you will get the August issue, where incidentally yours truly wrote an article, and one of the other I'll call it a patriotic show right now that I did around the 4th of July, someone else is writing a different article regarding veterans, and they're using the link to my program for Final Salute Inc. From that program with that article. So I encourage you to go to lapublishing.com and sign up for their free Brain Injury Journey online magazine. There was just one more quickie, and then I'm going to let you guys go. Area code 803.
Hello.
Meet Dr. Orin Marshall.
Hello. It's so nice to hear you tonight, and it was a wonderful interview. I appreciate everything you talked about. I live in an area that's called the CSRA, and it's between Augusta, Georgia, and Aiken, South Carolina, and a large area in between. And we have a large area of military survivors mm-hmm. living in this area. We have two VA medical hospitals. We have a hospital that was formerly called MCG. I can't say the name of it right now. It's a brand-new name. They've changed it. It's a gigantic medical hospital, level one trauma center, and they were meeting a lot of the survivors coming back from the current wars and the ones that are ending and everything, and it's just amazing to hear what you were talking about tonight. I want to thank you for coming on. I run two brain injury support groups, and I meet with a lot of people in those situations. I'm a brain injury survivor myself,
mm-hmm.
so I appreciate you coming on.
Well, you're welcome. It's our honor.
Thanks for calling in, Les.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. And what we will do, too, is that in your area, Marshall, you said that you've got something going on in that general area in November. Isn't that right?
Yes, we
do. Did you say Georgia?
Yes, in the Columbus, Georgia area, the first weekend of November, we are we're going to be at Calvary Baptist Church, I believe is the name of it there. And we're presenting a two-day conference entitled Hope Beyond the Battle. So if you go to hopeforthehomefront.com, you can get all of the details about Hope Beyond the Battle in Columbus, Georgia, first weekend of November.
Okay, great. If there's anything that I can't find on the website, Les Paul and I are friends, since you're having something in my area and in his area, I want to make sure that we both find that information,
okay.
Since we both have
great.
A base close by and we're both
right.
Willing to do the footwork on that. So both
great.
Of us
thank
will
you.
Check out that website, but if we have a problem finding it, then I'll just have you send both schedules or both of the details
sure.
to me, and I'll
be happy to
see
do
that
it.
Les
okay.
gets it. Okay, well,
okay.
I want to thank you guys. Both Dr. Kelly Orr and Marshall Carter Waddell for being on the show and sharing with us tonight, both for your service, for your struggle, and for all of the hard work that you're doing with these books as an outreach to help our veterans that are coming home, and also all of the rest of us, because it's in some of the work that's going on with the veterans right now and in the sports arena that the rest of us are finally getting to be heard.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, God bless both of you. I appreciate you being on the show. And if there's any last thing you want to say, please do. And otherwise, I will...
Well, I just want to say thank you. Thank you for inviting us to be a part of your program, and you're a very gracious hostess, and just appreciate the inspiration that I have found just listening to your story. And I just am amazed, just as we have been on this journey in the writing of the book and in the development of Hope for the Homefront and speaking here and there, the individuals that we meet, they're just unforgettable, and that's how I feel about you tonight. So thank you, and thank you to all the listeners and for all who have served and for all the family members who have served alongside. You're not alone. So.
That's right.
And I would,
Dr. Orr?
Yeah, I would just echo that. Kim, thank you very much. I'm just so amazed by your story, and actually you're an inspiration to Kathy and I. It gives us a little more of a sense of hope that, you know, we've been at this for 12 years. We're a little bit behind you, but just listening to you and thinking that we can still improve, we can thrive better, we can do something more. So for you and your listening audience and everything, been a pleasure to be on your show, and thank you very much for everything you do.
Thank you,
Kim.
Too, very much. And please, both of you, feel free to stay in touch with me. Again, about the seminars and things that you're putting on, and about your situation at home, if there's anything I can do to help, Dr. Orr. So thank you guys both for being here. And I'm going to close this part of the show. Again, for anyone who wants to stay, call in right now, 424-243-9540. Again, 424-243-9540. And I'm going to close the show in the usual way, and that's with something I believe that we all have. And this is Guardian Angel by Leah West. Be sure to check out her site at leahwest.com. Thanks, everybody, and we'll see those of you that are staying on the other side of 4 minutes and 45 seconds, and God bless and thanks for your support to my guests and all of you listening that will be dropping off now. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
As you grow and make your way.